This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects. This podcast features Director of Photography Adam Marsden, CSC, in conversation with Associate Member Martin Wojtunik and myself, Jeremy Benning. Adam discusses his work on the internet-crushing music video for Drake, Hotline Bling. This interview was recorded on February 18th, 2016.
So I'm Jeremy Benning.
I'm Martin Wojtunik.
And I'm Adam Marsden.
And we're here to talk to Adam Marsden about Hotline Bling and music videos in general.
So I guess the first question that I have, and I think it's a nice starting point, is how did the project come to you?
The project came to me really through a long-standing relationship with working with Director X. So I'd done several jobs with him over the past probably 10 years. And, you know, I think also for the fact that it was shooting in Toronto and we had the relationship and it had to be shot here. And I was approached by X to shoot it after years of collaboration.
Describe how long a process like this takes from conception to delivery, I guess. Like, so X reaches out to you. Mm-hmm. And then till the release of the video, like give me.
Well, I mean, I can speak up to production at least. I mean, and as we all know, working in this business, that varies. This particular project, I was approached probably about 5 days before.
Really, just 5 days?
Yeah, before. Wow. I went to camera. It's something that's. I probably would have liked a little more time for prep with, but fortunately, the production designer, Jeremy McFarlane, who's amazing, was on board a couple days before I was. And so obviously there's some extensive set builds that go on in this project. He was brought in maybe 7 days before the project. And, you know, and that really comes down to artist schedule. You know, which happens so often in music videos. Like, you know, these guys are on the road. They're, you know, they've got shows. They've got dates that they need to be in certain places. So, I think what really happened in this project is that Drake needed to get this done at a certain time, and his availability was, you know, those 5 days. Mm-hmm. Or the 2 days of shooting, but you know, he didn't really know his schedule until probably 5 days before. So yeah, that was about 5 days of prep.
That being said. You're a very well-known cinematographer in the city. How much added pressure is there working with an artist such as Drake? Like when a project like this comes to you, do you feel any added pressure?
You know, I guess yes. But, you know, in all honesty, I didn't realize the scope and scale, and I don't really look at it that way. You know, I've worked on larger projects in the past, and when I was approached, you know, there's always pressure. There is a lot of challenges with this job or this project just because of how technical it was and what we need to achieve in a short amount of time. Other than that pressure, I don't think the pressure really came from Drake as an artist or the scale of the artist. It really came from the amount of work we had to do in such a short amount of time.
Do you have people like executives or record label people sort of influencing decisions, or is that sort of... Is X used as a conduit to sort of stop that from influencing what you want to do as an artist?
At times there's pressure from label. In this particular situation, it's OVO, which is Drake's label. So there wasn't a lot of pressure from them. And I think because Drake and X had a relationship together, you know, X had a lot of freedom. So, in fact, it was probably one of the examples where there was the least amount of pressure, you know, and there was a fair amount of financial support, where if we needed to do things in a short amount of time and the budget started to blow up a little bit, it was easily approved by Drake because, you know, he realized what he needed from this. And, you know, and him and Drake and X also collaborate together. They've worked together several times. So I think if things start to grow, then, you know, then there's the freedom because Drake owns the label and it's his money ultimately paying for this. And, yeah, so there wasn't a lot of pressure from a label. There was actually quite a lot of freedom.
That's pretty cool. What And as you guys started working with like figuring out the design of the whole look of the thing, obviously LEDs came into play once you started working with the production designer, right?
Well, it wasn't just that they came into play with the production designer. They came into play because of what we needed to achieve in terms of light output in such a small amount of space.
Right.
You know, so, and intense color.
And where did you shoot it? What studio was it?
We shot at Revival Studios in Toronto. But again, going back to that, I mean, if we were trying to achieve that through, you know, first of all, there's elements to that. The lights need to dim and cycle through different colors, which is almost impossible to do with tungsten lighting without, you know, creating scrolling gel racks or things like that with the high intensity. We shot everything at 120 frames. So, I mean...
Everything?
Yeah, everything. Oh, wow. Like 90% of the video was shot at 120 frames.
Wow.
So, you know, to try and get that amount of light output with gel filters on a lamp that take, you know, that have like a 12% transmission value, you know, and scrolling through different things would be almost impossible.
Yeah.
And also having them as compact as they were. So... Yeah, it came at a really good time in terms of technology. Like LED RGB lighting technology gave us the intensity and the freedom to cycle through a color wheel and choose colors specifically.
Right.
You know, and fit them into our sets and our environments, incorporate them into the sets, which is something that was very important. You know, it needed to be feel like the light was being emitted from the set itself.
Yeah. And these lights that you were using, were there any that you had not used before in the past? Like were these some of these new fixtures that you hadn't seen before or only recently seen, or
yeah, absolutely. Well, and as you know, and as you asked the question, you know, I actually had contacted you about some information based on your experience with LED, and was very helpful. But yeah, going through which you referred me to PRG and John Moriarty over there, there are fixtures I used before. I had used the LED fixtures, specifically the Chroma Q Color Force fixtures. But I hadn't used them in RGB. So that was a first time for me of working with full spectrum RGB lighting.
Right. And then, and as far as the actual programming of it, you had a dimmer board up there with you, right?
We did. Yeah.
Yeah.
It also provided through PRG. And unfortunately the name of our dimmer board op escapes me at this point. But he was great. I mean, it was a very positive experience.
How much time did you have to spend doing the programming per setup?
Oh, we spent a lot. We spent, well, God. We pre-lit and pre-programmed a lot of it, you know, the day before.
So maybe take us through some of that, like as far as the timeline of the set build and then when the lighting was brought in, how much time you had to install and then program and that kind of thing.
Right. So, I mean, we basically had one day of pre-lighting, and at the same time, in our really condensed schedule, the production design team was still finishing up sets, and we were sort of stumbling over each other to light and finish building sets. But, you know, I would say, like, the installation of any given set, for example, the stairway set, I mean, that was what we really focused on. And because we had built six sets.
And all these sets were standing in the same space, right?
We had sets over two different studios.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we had three sets in our main larger studio, and then we had a bit of a smaller studio that had another two sets in it. So, and we were revolving sets as well as that happened. So we've primarily focused on the main standing set, which was the staircase set, and that took the better part, probably a good 8 to 10 hours to pre-light. And, you know, and the programming with that, I mean, obviously we had to wait to get the lights installed before we could start programming and doing certain things. So, you know, but we would do it in stages. So we would light the upper perimeter of the sets and then start to work on the programming of that. And then, you know, right, the porthole in the middle of the set and then start to work on the programming of that. And then the behind the stairs of, you know, of the staircase, we would, so we worked in stages. And I would say in terms of the programming time, you know, it was easy between 2 to 3 hours per section to do that. Wow.
And how, so as you were installing this stuff, like were you...
And that's not because of being inefficient. It's just about, you know, setting our pacing of it, what it is, you know, collaborating with X when we get him, because he's obviously working on other things at the same time and bringing him in.
Showing him what it looks like.
Yeah, showing him what it looks like. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? And, you know, yeah, so I mean, it's you know, I feel like we probably could have done a lot faster if there weren't so many voices involved that need to sign off on decisions.
Mm-hmm. And then, but as you were doing it, were you, because obviously you're dealing with transmitting the light through the spandex that was wrapped around the set pieces, right?
Yes.
So were you, I mean, some of the stuff is elevated, like the staircase set. There's elements that are up in the grid. So were you able to test stuff on the ground to see the spread of the things before you committed to putting them up high, or how'd you deal with that?
Yes, but in fact, I did that at PRG prior to all of that.
Oh, so you had a sample there, and
that's right. So okay. I went and met with John, and you know, we set up, you know, the Best Boy floods, and you know, actually escapes the name of the ellipsoidal fixtures that they have that are RGB as well. But you know,
what the Best Boys?
There's the Best Boys, and then there was the Fresnel version and the ellipsoidal version.
Oh, the Best Boy Spot.
The Best Boy Spot.
Best Boy Wash. Then,
no, there was something Wash in the Best Boy Spot. Uh-oh. which I can't remember.
They're all very similar names. I find them very confusing because they're all very similar names.
As do I. but we went in and tested them, you know, to try and get a sense of their photometrics. You know, and that also with the strip light, the LED strip lighting, the color force.
Yeah.
So, like we used the 78s. So I'd already got a sense of, you know, what I was going to get in terms of intensity.
Output.
In the output, yeah.
So did you actually have a piece of the spandex there and a piece of the set?
I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And then, so what were your primary fixtures? The actual light, the spandex set pieces, what were the primary fixtures used for that?
The
primary fixtures that you used to light the spandex set pieces.
The primary fixtures were the
72s?
The 72s, yeah.
Right. The Chroma Q 72s?
Correct. The Chroma Q RGB 72s, yeah.
Yeah, great.
I kind of want to take it back for a second. You did so much research on how to light these set pieces, but what came first, the set pieces or the lighting? How informed was your dialogue with Jeremy McFarlane, the production designer? Traditionally, your relationships are super important between a production designer and a DP.
Absolutely.
How was it on this show?
Jeremy and I worked really extremely closely together. I mean, he works proficiently, you know, in SketchUp and a 3D modeling software, which I also have access to and own on my computer. So we would go through model after model and discuss, you know, where to hide the lights, what diffusions to use, you know, in designs. And of course, on top of all of that, there's also approval from X and Drake and what the set design is. But, you know, after that was all approved, yeah, Jeremy and I consistently were working on what fixtures we should be using, how we can install them. I mean, one of our biggest struggles were on that staircase set. If you recall looking at the video, everything is evenly lit all on the outside. Well, that's something that we couldn't achieve from a budgetary standpoint because they couldn't afford at that point to install the lights into the set. So I basically had to defer, not even defer, but suggest that we defer to post-production because we could either build extensions to hide these lights. You know, and we struggled with this too because X wanted very clean edges all the way around. So if we were going to inset the lights to light the ceiling pieces, then it wouldn't have been as clean edge as you wanted. We would have had these little bulkheads that were around and it wouldn't have been the color and light right to the very edge.
Uh-huh.
You know, so what I proposed is that, you know, we will light the sets from the outside so we can light edge to edge and then rely on post to actually cut out and take those lights away, which is what we ended up doing.
So I guess that's one of the other things is that decision to go with the post. The edges of the borders of the frames that we see is basically a post mat that's color matched to the lighting to make the edges clean.
Ultimately, what they did is we rigged the lights out from the set and skimmed them across the top of the set. So really what we just did is cut the lights out of the shot and then they extended a little bit of the set to blend it into, you know, basically to blend it in, to cover up where the lights would have been.
Right.
Where the empty space was, where they cut out.
Right,
lights.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It was set extension as well as rig removal and light removal.
Okay, cool.
You touched on that you shot 120 frames earlier. Give me the nerd breakdown. What cameras, lenses, we touched on lighting, but what were some of the tools that you used to achieve this particular look?
Well, we shot Arri Alexa. That was our camera of choice. And, you know, I shot with a set of Cook 5Eyes was our lens of choice, being that they're a high-speed lens. They open up at 1.4, and we needed that amount of light to shoot at such a high frame rate. So, those were my main tools of choice outside of the camera platform, which was the Scorpio crane and the Scorpio head. And that was chosen basically because X wanted this constant fluid in and out motion throughout. And, you know, it's also, you know, much more time efficient based on what we had to achieve in a day to be able to do that, move a crane around, find our shot, telescope in and out, find our frames. It's obviously a very versatile tool.
Mm-hmm.
Are you operating the Scorpio head?
I'm operating the head, yes. So, and then we have our technicians operating the telescopic elements of the arm, and then, well, we didn't actually move the base, but yes.
How big is a crew traditionally for this size of project?
Well, on this project, I think we had a crew, a grip crew of about 5 and a lighting crew of about 5 or 6 as well.
Who are your keys on the show?
The keys on the show, well, my key grip was Chris Atkinson, who's a fantastic key grip, and actually Sammy Hajar, who is someone I came up with in music videos years ago and hadn't worked with in a long time and did a fantastic job on it.
Yeah, Sammy's great.
Yeah, he is.
Going back to LEDs for a little bit, do you feel that this project could have been executed without the use of LED technology?
No, not for the budget that they had. And realistically, I don't believe that it could have been. I think the technology was a large part of the end result.
So like 5 years ago, this probably couldn't have been achieved.
I guess it probably could have been achieved,
but not for the cost.
Yeah, not for the time. Cost. Not for the cost and the time, you know, and the size of fixtures. Yeah, I believe it would have been very difficult to achieve it, and very costly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, here's something I want to touch on with RGB that I learned on this project is, you know, I learned that working with RGB, and Jeremy, you could probably attest to this because I know you've worked a lot with it with the Expanse.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Is really using your vector scopes. That was something that was that hit me right away. It's very easy to get into an illegal color situation with these really saturated like RGB channels of light. It's like, you know, you can easily get outside your vector scope and everything becomes a little mushy and soft, and you're pushing the limits of broadcast legal color.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I can see in your case it would be actually harder to detect visually on the monitor because you're dealing with such even fields of color.
Absolutely.
I mean, for
right.
me, I found that same thing, but I could see it because it was
on a reference point of white somewhere.
Or I would have like an object or a thing that would be clipping. You could see it on the monitor clipping.
Sure.
But you're dealing with big open fields of color where you can't really judge.
And all color. I mean, there were washes of everything.
There's no
there was
texture
no,
or
there
shape.
Was no,
or,
there was no point of white to be like, okay, well, yeah. here's the point on the scope. It's like, you know, or just by your eye looking at
right.
the monitor. So what I found is I was starting to go, you know, the director was like, the color needs to be more saturated. It's like, we need more color. And I'm like, you know, you have to trust me with this. You know, we can't keep pushing color into it. You know, we can rely a little bit on the post-production process and the final grade to increase saturation.
Of course.
But certainly not do it in camera because we're pushing the limits of what the camera sensor is capable of.
Yeah, then you end up with a mess.
But basically a mushy, noisy image.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can't bring that back or down or whatever. Yeah.
No, then you're screwed.
One thing I could talk about, I mean, both, you know, for people who don't know, Adam and I, we both started the music videos many years ago. We worked together. There was a company called Blackwalk that we were both started out as
well,
DPs.
Yeah, and in fact, just sorry to interrupt, but you know, you've been my mentor. You know, I started under you. I was your assistant for years, and as well as close friends. So yeah, there's a long-standing history between us.
There is, and we've also both seen the evolution of music videos from, you know, their late 90s, early 2000s up
That's
until
right.
now. So we've seen what I would consider them was the golden era of music videos.
Now,
you know, it's not what it was. I mean, the fact that, you know, what you did with this video with Hotline Bling is a rare thing. I mean, that these kinds of videos don't get made that much anymore to that level of production design and budget. It's only the very kind of select few, you know, higher end artists and bigger, you know, name artists that get to make videos like this. So, I mean, what can you say, I guess, from your experience of seeing starting in the beginning, and you know, you've done so many great music videos, and you got known as being, you know, a fantastic music video DP. That was sort of where you cut your teeth.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, you did. I mean, that's, and people knew you for that, and you got asked to do a lot of really amazing creatives and high profile, you know, videos. You know, back when videos were in their golden era of that sense. So, what have you seen? I mean, obviously, because you don't do them as much now, simply because they don't exist as much anymore on that, you know, on a level that's what they were. So what have you seen in the last, like, say 10 years? What's changed? And, you know, why don't you do music videos as much anymore? What's changed about them that's different from what they were when you started?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest things that have changed is, you know, is budgets and the way labels and artists want to put money into, you know, into their music videos and, mm-hmm. and online and everything. It seems like, I mean, you know, we came from an era where there was MTV and Much Music, you know, and there was a format or a platform for music videos and broadcasts. And, you know, now a lot of times they go straight to the web. I mean, this is now the new, you know, the new.
Right. And how many, like, hundreds of millions of views has this video had now? Hotline Bling?
Well, this is an anomaly for sure. I mean,
right.
I'm looking it up right now.
What's that?
I'm looking it up right now.
No, it's definitely, it's been interesting to, you know, I feel very fortunate, and I think as we both do, to have come into the industry, and I mean, I can speak for myself, but also yourself. I mean, we really started in music videos, as you said, in that sort of golden era of music videos.
What would you say, you know, because obviously you do a lot more than just music videos. You started doing that, but now you do commercials and you do features. And what do you think that are the things that, I guess, what, you know, the way to say it, because I remember back in the time when I was doing it, and, you know, there were, sometimes people would look at music videos at that point of like, oh, it's a lower art form. It's a lower craft in some sense, because it was sort of this like bastard child of the film industry or whatever. But what would you say?
Well, to a point, yeah, it was. But then you have directors like David Fincher, who started, you know, working in music videos and built a career into commercials and into features.
But I'm talking about here in Toronto, per se. You know, in our field, that, you know, music videos were often seen as like, oh, that's where, you know, it's a smaller thing. So, but what would you say you've gotten from that that maybe has given you an advantage over other people, or has given you something that you know, that you've learned or gained as an art form that you wouldn't have had if you'd started in some other genre of the industry?
Well, I mean, I think one of the greatest things about music videos is it was the perfect platform to experiment, mm-hmm. you know, and really hone a craft and an art form, mm-hmm. you know, and we're always constantly doing that, obviously, through anything we do, but there's that period was such a creative period, you know, or there wasn't people standing over you being like, this is my product and make it look this way. And like, we weren't as controlled as we are now in terms of advertising, you know, as bands being a product. At that time, it was considered an art form. And because people didn't really know and understand what it was, you know, especially, again, labels, it was like, you know, hey, like, we're going to let these people do what they want to do because whatever, you know. So it was a pretty special time, I think, for all of us, certainly for me, and to experiment, you know, and to learn, to try things where people aren't standing over you being like, well, that's not right. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, there was no right. And there was a lot of room for experimentation and growth. And
do you feel that that's because of where, I guess the question is that I have is, do you think it's because of that, or do you think it's because of the democratization of technology? In the sense that, do you think that now you're being a little bit more loomed over your shoulder because now a client can see exactly what red is like, what blue is like, what overexposure is, what underexposure is? I feel like there's a sense of alchemy that's been lost now because of the democratization of digital, and now everybody's breathing over your shoulder.
Right.
That's interesting, and there may be part of that, but I also think in the music video medium, It was at a time where it was just like it wasn't monetized the same way, you know. It was like you were given a lot of freedom, you know. Even at that, people could look at a color video tab and be like, but no one really questioned that. So yeah, you know, to answer your question, I think technology has changed that a little bit. I don't know if that's I don't think that's the sole reason. You know, I think
490
million views of the Hotline Bling video.
Wow.
That's pretty crazy.
Does that include all the memes?
No, that's just the video itself. And it's got 2 million, is that million or billion? 2 million likes and
2 million
236,000 thumbs down.
Your ratio is pretty
good. Good ratio.
Your ratio is pretty good. 5% dislike ratio. Yeah. Compared to a 95% approval ratio. Yeah.
very low troll rating.
Well, that's great for Drake.
You started off with film.
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah.
Do you feel that digital has allowed you more freedom and expressing your creativity more than film ever did?
I don't know if I'd say it's given me more freedom. The immediacy of the of seeing the image and having the control over the image in the moment on set, that I love. I mean, it's something I love. I don't know about freedom because it's something interesting has happened. Now that people, you know, with the digital medium and where it goes through the post pipeline and editors and whatever, I actually find after film has gone by the wayside that there's less importance for the cinematographer to be involved with the final grade, depending on what it is. Now I'm talking in the commercial industry.
In short format,
correct, yeah. You know, I find something's been lost there. So does it give more control? On set, in the moment, for sure. And the immediacy of being able to see your image, you know, actually a grade, what we used to would go in at the end of a shoot day after we send our daily, our, you know, break-offs and send them into the lab and do our transfers and, you know, in our quick one-lights, we can now do that on set and even fine-tune it even more than we could then. You know, that I love, but I feel like now in the short format industry, at that point, it kind of slips out of our fingers a little bit. So you put this energy into creating a look, you know, on set, whether through lighting, through a bit of timing, working with your DaVinci software on set or whatever it is. And, you know, when then once it leaves your hands and goes to the post house, to the editors and whatever, and then goes to final grade, strangely, I feel like there's a bit of loss of control in the short format world.
You have to fight a little harder to be involved.
Yeah, if you're even asked sometimes.
If you're even asked. Or you have to kind of like make a point of saying, hey, I want to be part of that.
Well, and we all do. I think we all try to. I mean, yeah. Certainly it's, you know, for me, when it goes on any project, it's stated, it's like, yes, want to be involved to completion. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, you know, agencies and clients and, you know, they have their own agenda and they have their own thing in mind and they may be on board in the moment, but they also have clients and people have proven that it's like...
Too many cooks and they just want to make it easier for them. And
Yeah. And I feel there's been a lot of, you know, being cut out of that post back end process, mm-hmm. you know, where strangely when it was film, I felt like we're more involved with that. I found myself going to more final transfers when it was transfers.
I think probably because at that point there was more of a...
I think it was still residual of the system where it was like the cinematographer was, you know, the cameraman, the image maker, like mm-hmm. working with the chemistry, working with everything. And, you know, and it was sort of trailing off the end of where that's what the cinematographer did. Now it's just become more media based and, you know.
Well, especially with this like Instagram kind of era, like everyone feels like they know how to make an image.
You can add any filter to anything. Absolutely. Right. You know, and yeah. So I feel there's been, and that depends. I don't want to generalize. I mean, there are certain creative teams out there, you know, and directors or whatever that will bring you in and keep you involved. But, you know, a lot of times it slips out of your fingers and it's beyond your control, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Right.
I kind of want to know, what are some of your influences?
I guess my influences really, a lot of them come from where I started in music videos, you know, guys like Fincher coming up with that, or Mark Romanek, and, you know, I also come from a fine arts background. You know, I don't have a filmmaker's background. I never went to film school. You know, I studied fine arts. So I came into this. I guess that's why I was really attracted to music videos when I slipped into it in background. I mean, I started as a PA and really would be on set with some.
You were an art department PA.
I started as an art department PA. That's right. And then into production and mm-hmm. into gripping and technical work, but. Yeah, it was the visual experience, and you know, so yeah, that's my background. That still has been what's inspired me, you know, and that's sort of bridged into being, you know, a visual storyteller, you know, and we did that in music videos, sometimes abstractly, sometimes more narratively. But what I learned through all that is that I actually really enjoy the narrative storytelling process, so making decisions, you know, to help propel a story of some way, whether it's a visual story or whether it's a narrative story, whatever. But that's, you know, that's, I guess that's in a nutshell.
I find a lot of cinematographers come up an avenue, whether it's camera assisting or it's lighting. And I feel that it's really predominantly those two avenues that they come up into. What was yours?
Mine was all of it. And that's something I learned actually, or realized, not learned, but realized very early on. you know, starting as a PA and in the art department, and then as a production PA. You know, once I figured out, when I first started, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that I was overwhelmed and really inspired by what was going on in front of me, like working in music videos. So once I sort of figured out, you know, and I had this photography hobby, I would bring my camera to set and shoot behind the scenes and shoot lighting. And it's really interesting because I, excuse me, I came up with in fine arts, and I'll never forget this. When I went to a fine arts high school as well. And I remember doing figure drawing, and my teacher would always be like, just look at where the light's coming from. Look at where the light's coming from. And I would be like, you know, drawing these models, and I'm like, I'm drawing the light and the shadow on the models, but I never understood where the source of the light was coming from. For whatever reason, it just didn't click with me. And, you know, I'll never forget being on set and working in music videos. It was actually on a Lisa Mann music video.
Yeah.
And Chris Seuss was shooting it. He was another one of our peers and a very established DP. And
he was part of that era with us. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I remember sort of really all of a sudden paying attention to a light being set up and seeing that the light was there, how the light was hitting the subject and casting a channel. I'm like, all of a sudden, everything just sort of clicked. Literally, the light turned on. I was like, oh my God, I get it now. And like, instead of looking at the subject, like, all of a sudden I saw the big picture, like, oh my God, here's the light from this direction, and here's the shadow that falls on this side. And like, that to me was the moment I'm like, I realized that's where I want to shoot. You know, whether I've been a photographer, whether I've been a cinematographer, but that's where I realized photography was something that really, really clicked to me. Mm-hmm. And in that moment of realization, I also realized I need to learn more than just, you know, being a PA on set, which was great. I mean, it was something that was, I learned so much, and I was like, I want to learn about lighting, you know? So what I chose the avenue, you know, in the North American system, you know, it's like the British system is very different. You know, you have your grips who are responsible for camera and camera platform and camera support. And then you have your electrical department that's, you know, about lighting, you know, shaping, sculpting, diffusing, coloring. In Canada, there's a crossover, or in North America, there's a crossover of that. It's, you know, the grips shape and diffuse and color and work with the lighting. So, you know, for me, I looked at that as like, this is a great opportunity. Like, I would rather be a grip where I can learn camera, movement, you know, shaping, sculpting lights, and at the same time, you get to learn about the light fixtures that the electricians are setting in. So I made the decision to start gripping. And then after doing that for a few years, or a couple of years, Jeremy and I, who have been close friends for a long time, Jeremy started shooting more and more, started shooting music videos. And, you know, we were hanging out a lot and shooting a lot on our own, doing our own little projects and shooting on the old Airy ST, which I still own to this day, and which previously was yours.
That's right.
But, you know, there was an opportunity, and I did fast track a little bit. So, I remember reading John Fowler's Airy handbook and learning everything, every system, learning the SR, learning the Airy 3 BLs. And the Airy 2C, and learning the BLs exactly, and started assisting with Jeremy on these smaller budget music videos. So and then bridging into camera. So yeah, so for me it was important to understand, you know, the whole process. I think when it comes down to shooting, I think we can all attest to this. I mean, we all do this. Like, I mean, we make our decisions based on instinct, you know, and what we think feels right, you know. And I think that's part of being as trite as this may sound of being an artist. I mean, you know, there's no right way to do anything. You know, it's whatever feels right to you, you know, and whatever your script is or whatever your piece of music is that you're inspired by, whatever your inspiration is, you know, wherever you feel the right thing is. That's what defines you. That's what separates you from anyone else. I mean, that's who you are. So
continuing on your influences, what is a film? You said you came from this arts background. What is a film that spoke to you? What is a film that you wish that you had shot?
That probably changes every other month or year or whatever, like constantly. I'm going to go to the most current contemporary example, and that's The Revenant. I mean, come on, like what a fantastic opportunity to have the time and schedule to shoot only with natural light when the sun is in the lowest part of the sky, and it's amazing. Come on, Lebesgue, like, that's a dream job. Sure, that's, I would say right now that would be one. But I mean, there's many. There's many. You know, one that always stands out to me. I've always respected someone like Darius Kanji, and specifically when his collaboration with Fincher in Seven. Like, to me, that was something at a time. I was just like, oh man, it's so rich. You know, I'm a big fan of Chiaroscuro. I love the style and look of that film, and the deep blacks, and so there's another one. But I mean, we could all go on about many, many films that we would love to have shot.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because especially music videos, you find that, and in commercials too, oftentimes people want to show you references, right? So you're almost always shown like, oh, this is what we want it to look like. And I always thought it was funny back in the day where, in the, you know, the earlier days of music videos, when people would show you this like $500,000 music video and they'd say, well, this is the look we want. And then you've got like $10,000.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's great. But like, that's like a, you know.
You know what I've learned though? You may not be able to do it to the scale.
No, but you take the essence of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I guess what I was getting at more was the idea of, as a cinematographer, it's interesting how, you know, you're often asked to copy somebody else. It's like, here, we love this look. We want you to do that.
Sure.
And it's always like, well, why can't we just do something fresh? Like, why does it have to always be, here, copy this?
But I think we can. And I think...
Well, then you figure out a way to make it your own
thing. Yeah, you use that as an inspiration.
Of course.
You know, and then try and make it your own.
But it is often, it's a funny thing that, you know, how often as, you know, if to call yourself an artist, how often is an artist compared to, say, other artists where you're actually purposely asked from the get-go, like, here's this thing, we want you to copy it. Please take this and mimic it. So it's funny how often we're asked to be kind of like reverse engineers of other art, of like, here's a thing, we want you to figure out how this was done and then copy it.
Yeah. I think that's going on through the histories of time.
Like, of course, but if cinematography, probably more than a lot of other art, maybe photographers probably deal with it too. But in terms of like...
I think painters have, I think many artists have.
Sure. But I mean, because we make sort of like pop culture in a sense, mm-hmm. we're often asked to reproduce other pop culture.
Absolutely.
You know?
True,
so I mean,
yeah.
it's maybe bands go through it where like a band is asked to like, hey, we're, you know, they go to their producer and say, we want to sound like you too. I mean, but it's not the same because they're still going to sound like their band. But as a cinematographer, you're asked to like try and recreate a lighting look or some stylistic look, and you're basically saying, you know, it's kind of like here's this example. Figure out what it is and then reproduce it in some way, because that's what they want. They want that look.
Yeah, more often than not, that's the case.
Yeah,
for sure. And what do we do, Jeremy? What do you do? What do you do?
Well, you try and find it. I mean, it's with directors that I know who do it. It's often, sometimes I'm like, part of me is like, oh, can't we just do something on our own? Like, why do we always have to reference something else? You know. But then the other side of me is like, okay, well then fine. This is what. The client wants that. They sold that to the client. So we'll find our own way to make it new and special.
Yeah, and I think that's what we all do. That's it's exactly right. I mean,
but there's always a part of me that's kind of like, really, why do we have to like copy that?
I think that when people are asking that, it's not about necessarily copying it. It's what's inspired them, you know.
There are some examples where it literally is, we want this. They show you the thing and like that.
And then you're like, well, you should hire that DP then.
Yeah. So there is that, you know. There is that, you know.
Us can't afford that luxury yet,
right? Well, that's true, of course. You know, and that's a funny thing too. I mean, like, you know, it's something. This is something that I've struggled with, and I think, but we all probably have struggled with. It's like identity. It's like, you know, I remember very early on in my shooting career, like people would be like, oh, well, that's the Adam Marsden look. Prince of Darkness, I would get. And I would get that often. And I always sort of, in the beginning, I took that as like, oh man, that's the thing. Because I think, you know, maybe it's ego or whatever it is, but I think we all like to feel like, you know, we can do it all. We can do anything. We can, you know, hey, give us something and we can create a look. But, you know, there is certain instincts that we all have in us, you know. You have a style, I have a style, you know. And I think that's a good thing. That's what sets us apart, you know. And there used to be a time where I felt like I should be able to deliver any look that anyone is asking for. It's like, yeah, you want to create a Kanji look? Great. You want to create a, you know, a Willis look? Great. You want to create, you know, whoever. You know, name a DP or a photographer or whatever, or a painter or whatever. It's like, great, we should be able to do that. But the fact of the matter relies in, I think that you know, we all have instincts, mm-hmm. and that's what sets us apart. That's what makes us different. And you know, I think that's a good thing.
And that's the value you bring to a project.
Yeah.
That's why you're asked. Is like there's something in your work that maybe you don't even see it, but someone looks like there's something about that that guy's work that I wanna capture somehow.
Right. So maybe one day people will be like, I want this to look like The Expanse.
Right.
it's beautiful. And some young DP is gonna be like, oh man, why don't you just hire Jeremy Benning?
I've said that countless times, actually.
So have I. So have I, and I mean that genuinely.
I don't know how he does it. He just does it. But that being said, now you having a look or falling into this look that it's just like, it's a taste thing. Film or digital?
Sorry?
Film or digital? Oh.
You know, I to me, again, it's not a one or the other thing. It's, you know, digital's it's another thing in your quiver. Like now it's hard to shoot film. It's costly for production. I mean, film's expensive, processing's expensive, you know, and like, transferring's expensive, and going through the process of making print. I mean, it's an expensive thing. So, you know, we're kind of at the mercy of, you know, of the bean counters. That's where we're at. You know, and I would hope and love if we can make decisions strictly creatively. It's like, hey, you know, let's shoot film in this project because we really want to manipulate the image in a certain way, or we want to embrace the grain of this, or we really want to use this chemical technique, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That would be, you know, would be great. Or let's shoot digital because we like the look of this, and you know, and we can move faster, and we can do whatever. Like, I mean, there's many reasons to make a decision on what your media is, and
you know. I mean, and now, I mean, there's the practical realities of that film has just become impractical.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at.
It's so, like,
do you want film or digital question anymore?
No, it's like, do you want the steam engine or do you want the DSLR? It's like,
yeah, and it's not even the steam engine. It's like it's really come down to a dollar situation. It's like.
Yeah, but there's also just the fact that, you know, film cameras aren't maintained anymore. So if you're going to get a film camera, then it's like, where does it come from? How well is it maintained? Is it going to scratch your film? How you know, where's the film going to get processed? How long is it going to take?
I mean, sure. I mean, but you go back to an Arri camera or whatever that still you can get a hold of, and I mean, they're pretty reliable, you know, sources for image capture. But
it's more the risk of and I mean, I can say this because I had someone ask me about a year and a half ago to shoot a feature. And they wanted to shoot on film, and they were insistent, like, it was a period piece, and they're like, we want to shoot on film, and they were selling it to me, like, they would assume, like, oh, the DP's going to love this idea. But it was a smaller budget, like, a $2 million film shooting in Northern Ontario somewhere, and my first thought was, like, I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, your film's going to, you're not going to see your rushes for a couple days.
That's right,
you've got a very tight schedule. If anything happens to that film...
Yeah, there's practical elements
You got no way to react. Like, then you're going to, like, how are you going to reschedule to reshoot? Like, the sets have been, you've moved on from that location, whatever. I said, I don't, honestly, I think for this project, it's not a good idea. I think it's too much of a risk. And at the end of the day, you know, it's going to come back to us as the cinematographer in that situation, like, oh, why is the film ruined?
The interesting thing is that both of you guys, both Jeremy and Adam, you're some of the biggest proponents of pushing digital in the city. Not only have you guys embraced technology, both digital and LED lighting, and pushing formats sort of to a new place that haven't been gone to before. Is there a project that can come to you that you would say from now, starting now, is there a project that would come to you, for example, and say, I guess, push to shoot 35 in the sense that if you had the budget, if there was a time limitless factor?
I mean, for me, I feel like, I mean, I haven't shot film since 2009. So I kind of feel like I've so embraced the digital workflow and the control that I have. I mean, it's going back to what Adam was talking about how having our control over the look and being involved with the workflow. I feel like if you set up the digital system properly or in the right way, I guess the way I would do it is that you maintain control because you would set the look as you're shooting. You're able to set a grade while you're shooting it. Everyone sees it and everyone kind of signs off. Like, this is the look. We like this look. It's the look. And I think if everyone's on the same page and you're able to kind of do the planning and get yourself in the right orientation that way, when people see the look, that then they, it's sort of like a subconscious thing that becomes what they're used to seeing the world that way.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll start editing, they'll go through the months of the weeks of cutting. By the time they get to the final grade, that is now, they've gotten so used to seeing that look, and that's so become the feel and the mood of the piece that they, that's what they assume, that's the look now. So whereas with film, you're always going to have that remove process of some other person is going to take the film and transfer it and grade it and maybe not do it the way you thought it might be, but then that's what they're going to look at for weeks. And if you're not around to do the final grade,
you're talking about in terms of like the rushes and
Right. So for me, I see that the way the post works, the digital, if you can set it up a certain way from the get-go, you actually have more control than with film. And there's a certain, I think you can be a little bolder. You can be bolder. You can take more risks, and there's that confidence of like it's in focus. We know we got that take. It's everyone's can go, great, there it is, the end. Whereas, you know, with film, you might come back the next day, oh, that one part of the close-up that we really wanted is soft and no one saw it.
That's actually a really huge point.
And for me, it's like I've so much embraced that part of the digital workflow and even the ability to then at the end of the day take stills of what you're, you know, grabbing stills off the footage and show it to everyone. Like, so now you create a little gallery of like a little like greatest hits of the day, like a storyboard almost of what you've shot. And everyone can look at it and it's like, oh, wow, there's their day. It's like, that's it. And everyone has that kind of, that sense of, it's not just about what I'm doing. It's what it does for the whole team. Like,
yeah, it's confidence. Producer. You know, you've gotten it. Everything feels,
everyone feels has a confidence level. Like, yeah. And it's, so for me, I kind of like, I, as much as I love shooting on film, now that we've gotten so advanced and sophisticated with the digital process, it's like, I can't imagine going back to looking at the YouTube quality video assist.
I just to interject for a minute. I have to say this, like, and I totally agree with you, but there is something to be said about what's, again, going back to what I said, like, you know, it's just another quiver.
Sure. How informed is your process as a shooter based on where it's going to end up? YouTube, broadcast, cinema. Talk a little bit about that. Like, how do you change or fluctuate as a DP based on where it's going to end up?
You know what? In all honesty, I probably should more than I do. You know, you know, I'll work off a calibrated monitor for the way I see things. I mean, that's kind of what you have to do. You can't light an for the world when there's settings different on every monitor. I mean, that's...
You can only go by one standard.
You can. And so, and that's it. So you need to sort of, you know, you need to focus on what, you know, whatever your control monitor is and light for that.
Consistency is everything in that situation. Just be consistent.
You're absolutely right. And that's absolutely well put. That's right. Just consistency. Consistency is right. And if it's going to be someone's settings are different, then at least it's consistent. It's like exactly, you're exactly right.
That's right. And it's, you know, you can't approach it. Because there's the shooting part of it, and then there's the going into grading it part of it, which is going to be different from when you shot it. So the monitor and the grade is going to be different from when you shot it.
But again, consistently across the board. It's like it needs to be consistent.
Then you go into a grade, you have a consistent monitor to work
from. So it'll be consistently shit with someone with a Vivid TV setting on their monitor, and it'll be consistently nice with whatever.
Right. But you know, the people
who really... I don't mean shit, but just not what you...
Not what you intended.
For. Yeah.
But the people that are really... You know, passionate or the cinephiles, they'll have the Blu-ray player with the cinema settings.
Exactly.
That's what you're making it for. Making it for those people who want the same standard as the filmmaker used, and that's all you can really aim
for.
Absolutely
right. Very well put.
How important is a colorist in your process?
Oh well, massively. It always has been. I mean, even in film. I mean, your timer was always your right hand man. Like, you know,
a woman.
Or woman, sorry. but yeah, you're right hand person. It's like that, I mean, that's your back end person that you're working with, you know, to fine tune your look. I mean, obviously you're trying to do as much the camera as possible, but you know, when we went to film, there's inconsistency between batches of film and whatever. You're always dealing with that. Now in digital, of course, that's your fine tune. You know, and they're, you know, almost equally as important as you are. You know. Yeah, you're creating a look, but you're working with them to really hone that in and add the little details.
And tie everything together. Bring together all the
consistency. I mean, it's, again, going back to consistency. But also creating a look. I mean, there's only so much you can do in camera. I mean, you can go as far as you want, but in all honesty, when you're on the pressure of a day and certain things change and whatever, like you're shooting, you know, between the hours, you know, the late hours of sun when color temperatures are changing rapidly, You know, your ambient sky was at, you know, 6,000 degrees Kelvin, all of a sudden it's dropped to 10,000 degrees Kelvin, and like, you can't change that stuff up that quickly. And it's, I mean, you really, these are important people, mm-hmm. you know, it's a integral part of the process.
Jeremy, you said, was an influence. Was there any other CSC members that you were influenced by or
absolutely.
Worked for?
You know, Dylan McLeod was a huge influence to me. And I'll tell you, there's a actually a very important moment in my life where I was a PA. And everyone that I was surrounded with had gone to Ryerson and studied radio and or film and radio television arts. And I had this moment where I'm like, I feel like I have to go back to film school to do this. And I remember I was a PA, I was driving a panel van coming back from a wild strawberry shoot that Dylan was shooting with Lisa Mann again. And, I was talking to Dylan and he's like, I was like, I feel like I should go back to film school. I feel like I should go back to Ryerson. And, and he looked at me, or maybe he didn't look at me, but he said this. He's like, don't waste your time. He's like, you're already in this business. You're working, you're working all the time. It's like anything that you can learn that you would learn in film school, you can read in a book. So you want to learn theory, you can pick up a book. You know, you're getting hands-on experience. And he actually gave me this basically like cinematography, like, and I was talking about cinematography, and it's like, and he gave me this handbook. It was basically like cinematography for dummies. And he's like, hey, I'll give you this. Read this, but don't waste your time going back to film school because you're already doing it. And it was a huge marker in my life. Like I honestly was considering going back to school at the end of that summer. And, he dissuaded me from that, and I think was the right decision. And I don't even think I know it was the right decision. And, it's something that will always stick with me, and I really appreciate it. So, yeah, Dylan McLeod was someone who, was a huge influence. And I assisted for him several times, on some short films, some music videos, and I could tell you some stories about that would be really funny.
it's funny because I had the same sort of piece of advice from Chris Seuss, and because I was at the point of like I was in Ryerson, so Chris and those guys had all finished Ryerson, they had graduated, but I was now working at Blackwalk, and it was I was in school while I was also working at Blackwalk, and I was now finishing my second year of Ryerson, and it was now going into my third year, and that summer I was working on tons of videos, and I was sort of debating like, should I go back to school, should I keep working at Blackwalk, and I remember Chris Seuss saying to me, he said, why would you go? Why are you going back? And Chris is—he'd graduated. He'd gone through Ryerson, right? And he said, "Dude, like, why would you go back to school? Like, you're already in. You're in film school. This is the Blackwalk Film School. You should just stay here and keep doing your thing."
Totally.
And I was still wrestling with the idea of like quitting school, but I went back in the fall and did like a week, and within the period of time where you could still get your money back, and then I sort of taste tested for a week, and I'm like, I can't do this for another year. I felt like I'd gotten everything I needed out of it. And then I came back and continued to work at Blackwalk. And I was like, Chris was right.
Yeah, that Blackwalk was an amazing experience. It really was film school.
And it brings us back full circle to the Hotline Bling thing, because that's music videos started there for us. And that's where you're at now.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Adam.
Well, thank you, Marty.
For taking the time to come and sit with us, chat with us, and educate us.
You know, I have all the time in the world for both of you.
This podcast produced by Soundhouse.